represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Problems, problems, problems all day long. Will my problems work out right or wrong? My baby don't like anything I do. My teacher seems to feel the same.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You are listening to KFAR Radio. We're at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at KFARradio.com. My format is as usual. On Mondays, it's business and economics that affect Fairbanks and the state of Alaska. Tuesday's my day of politics, so my guest will be based around that. Wednesday, my guest is an interesting Fairbanks and pioneer, local legend, maybe even a nefarious character. Friday, it's all about Fairbanks, what we get to do over the weekend, those opportunities that are afforded to us, those things that make Fairbanks special. My job, it's to introduce this world, this planet, to the wonderful world of Fairbanks. Give everyone that Fairbanks fix we need once in a while. I'll try to get your phone calls, but sometimes our conversations just don't stop. Please be patient. I will get to them. We're at 458-TALK, 458-8255. And with that, I have four guests. I have on the phone calling in John Sturgeon in the studio here with me. I have Wayne Heimer, Al Barrett, and Craig Compo, sometimes known as the Laundry House Gang. And what we're going to do is they have a big issue that they're looking at. And I guess we could classify it as the potential takeover by the Federal Subsistence Board of hunting and fishing rights in about 11 million acres in Alaska. Is that about right, Craig?
Yeah, it's not too far off. There's a lot going on, and the Federal Subsistence Board doesn't really care what Alaskans think. You know, they got their own agenda, and they're... in our opinion, they're getting it all wrong.
John Sturgeon, you're calling in, and you're front and center on this. What are your thoughts and discussion points on this subject?
Well, it's something that's very concerning to hunters, that's for sure. First of all, thanks for allowing me on your program. Always love talking to Fairbanks folks, but it's something of major concern to hunters, and the proposal we have in front of the Subsistence Board right now. It's in Unit 23 and 26A. They're looking at local use only as the proposal, and it's 43 million acres of federal land.
43 million. Oh, I was just off by a factor of 300%. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a big, big area, and it's very concerning. And I think that all the hunters, if there's somebody that really needs meat for subsistence, and there's a shortage. I don't think I've ever talked to a hunter that said that those people should get preference. But this proposal basically is saying that non-local hunters are changing migration patterns of the caribou up in the west of Arctic herd by flying over with airplanes. And the thing they keep on saying over and over again is that the non-local hunters aren't as smart hunters as the locals, so that when a herd comes by, they shoot the lead cow, and then it changes the whole trajectory of the herd, and they don't go by the villages, which anybody who hunts caribou knows that the bulls are usually in the back. And
pushing his harem forward. That's right.
Right, and so it didn't make a lot of sense. And those were the reasons they were given by the, what they call the RAC, the local subsistence board, who makes recommendations to the statewide board. That is their argument, that migration patterns are changing because of influence by non-local hunters, and it's just not a lot of science involved in it, and that's our concern, that they're not following the procedures under an ILCA Title VIII. And once again, it's a case of federal overreach, and we're going to try to see what we can do about that to get things turned around.
Who started and wrote or submitted this initiative?
Well, it's a recommendation from the Rural Advisory Council in the Western Arctic area. They make a proposal to the main board, the Federal Subsistence Board, and that board has to consider any recommendations that come from the local, they call them RACs, RAC. And that's where it came from, and so they've had three public hearings so far. The first two were 4 hours each, and they had one last night that was about 2.5 hours, and a lot of people called from out of state and, of course, across Alaska, and was and at least what I've heard, it was overwhelmingly against passing this closure to non-locals.
So this is an area that submitted this that is a non... There's no roads out there anyway.
There may be some local roads around the village.
Yeah, but there's no road from Fairbanks or Anchorage into this area. There's no metropolis base like Fairbanks that can have someone go up the Hall Road and shoot a caribou.
No, it's not like that. And some of the area, the state of Alaska has already closed some of the river corridors, the airplane landing, which when they do that, it kind of means that locals are the only ones that hunt it, because the only way non-locals can get in there is they have to fly with an airplane. But if they can't land in the river corridors, they're forced farther out where non-locals don't usually go anyway. So there's been some accommodations by the state of Alaska, but I guess they're not satisfactory.
And is there a time frame where they review this and then vote it up or down?
Well, they've had three hearings, like I said, three public hearings, and they're going to have a hearing in front of the main board, the Federal Subsistence Board. That's going to be March 30th, and then they're going to decide which way to go on this. The management folks have some recommendations, close all of it or portions of it. What they're going to do, we don't quite know. Another thing that's kind of very disturbing on this whole process is that you don't get to face the Federal Subsistence Board. You've got to talk to staff over the telephone. You can't look eyeball to eyeball. Where you got to give a lot of credit to our Alaska Board of Game is that when you have a proposal or you're requesting something, you actually talk to the board. And those folks that are on the Board of Game, I always have admired them, because they listen attentively, and you get to talk to them directly. Where the federal system, you talk to people on a phone. That's all you can do.
Very good direct communication. Lane, you're the biologist in the room. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm the historian right now. I've got sucked into this whole federal takeover business probably when John was still enjoying the good life. And the reason we are in this pickle is through the text of Anilka. And the non-text of Anilka. Anilka, of course, is the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. It was a result of the Native Claims Settlement Act, because that was all about oil.
Mm-hmm.
We found oil up north. You couldn't transport it to the East Coast where it was needed by an ice-breaking tanker. That didn't work out. So we're going to have a pipeline. Not everybody thought the pipeline was a great idea. The Alaska Native interests in the north didn't like it. They threw in with the preservationists that didn't like it, because it was going to require a road and some development. And on the other side were the people that did want it, the economic developers. And eventually there was a grand compromise made where the pipeline people could get the pipeline. The Alaska Natives got settlement of their land claims, and the eco guys got the promise of a whole bunch of federal land and federal conservation units. And that all got sorted out in the Anilka legislation, which came along a little later. Well, in Anilka, which is not a wildlife management law, it's a land disposition law.
Yeah.
There's one little section Title 8, that it says subsistence. Well, because of the alliance that the Alaska Native interests had with the preservationists, they got to write subsistence in there. And it's a very interesting, if you're a wonk of some kind, I guess, or a strange person, it's very interesting to read what that says and what has actually happened. This Federal Subsistence Board, which is making up the rules, doesn't exist in there.
Yet they have power.
They do. And
John, are you on a road somewhere? It sounds like we have a lot of road noise in the back of your phone call.
Well, I'm sorry about that. I'll put you on mute because I had another meeting I actually had to here, so sorry about that. I'll shut
the mute. That's okay. Sorry. You know, you're driving Craig Compo crazy, and that's not easy.
No, I thought it was Dave. I just assumed Dave was.
Now that he has his own show, he's looking at all the technical aspects of me doing something wrong here, and it is not pretty, and it's going to get physical real fast.
I had a question for John, Dave, about the, and even Al can probably chime in, is the numbers, the actual harvest numbers, and why the argument is so weak, I think. Do you want to address that, or even John Sturgeon, whoever's got those numbers? I don't have them in front of me.
Could I finish my little story?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So the ANILCA, the subsistence section, says that it establishes if the state has not established a law of general applicability. If we are not providing for subsistence, then the feds can go ahead and the Secretary of Interior can formulate these regional advisory councils and the subsistence this and that. There are a couple of federal levels on there. And the big glitch is, did the state ever provide for subsistence or not? And, you know, the state argues that it did with our subsistence law.
Mm-hmm.
It's a law of general applicability. So that's so general that it drove the federal people nuts because they wanted only federally qualified rural residents to have subsistence privileges. Our law says all subsistence, all Alaskans do. So when that happened, they tried to bully us. It was a pretty rough and tumble deal. Jimmy Carter is generally represented as a nice guy, but he was a bullying shark when it came to this business. And the folks that are, there was a whiz kid years ago, his name's Robert Anderson. He was a whiz kid 30 years ago, I guess, and worked at BLM as a solicitor, and he invented the Federal Subsistence Board, basically patterned on the State Board of Game, which would allow locals some input into the regulations that were being made. Kind of the main difference between the Federal Subsistence Board and the Alaska Board of Game model is that the managers of the federal lands are the people that are on the Federal Subsistence Board. They're not really that concerned with, they don't have a mandate that says provide for use. They have a mandate that says provide for no use. And it's been a major goat rope for 30 plus years because these folks who don't exist in the legislation were created administratively to basically make the locals the managers. And, you know, in Alaska...
The local federal agencies.
Well, no, the local advisory boards.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in Alaska, we have the management is done for the interests of the general public, the state and the economy of the state and well-being. On the federal system, the mandate is different. And the preference that has been established for the rural residents essentially makes them the managers. And if you're the manager and you don't have a mandate to manage for everyone, you vote them off the island, and that's what's happening here.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. John, you going to stick with us for a bit?
You betcha. Got you on mute. Don't
okay. We'll be back. Fairbanks, we'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Right now, when you purchase a qualifying set of Bridgestone or Firestone tires, you can receive up to $120 back by mail on a Visa prepaid card. Visit American Tire and Auto and check out their in-stock lineup of quality Bridgestone and Firestone tires for your passenger cars and light trucks. Having a good set of tires is a smart investment, and why not save money doing so? And you can use American Tire's in-house credit card to save even more. From Firestone all-season tires rated for snow to Bridgestone's Alenza Ultra for SUV, CUV, and light trucks, the options are great. Stop by today. American Tire and Auto.
Don't miss 50-50 Friday on KFAR. Every Friday morning at 9 a.m. sharp, we offer up amazing gift certificates from different local businesses. That's when they go on sale for half price. From incredible food offers to fantastic services, you'll get it for half price every Friday at 9 a.m. So don't miss out on this offer.
It's been a rough winter, and now comes the freeze-ups. But don't fret. Have North Star Honey Wagon help with their state-of-the-art thaw truck. They'll have your lines cleared out in no time, helping make sure everything flows smoothly. North Star Honey Wagon, the new guys with the big shiny trucks and low rates, and now get your service at 50% off, as North Star Honey Wagon is this week's 50-50 Friday deal, just in time for spring. Whether it's pumping it out or thawing it out, North Star Honey Wagon are the ones to call. This week's 50-50 Friday.
This Friday morning at 9 a.m., log on to our website at KFAR660.com. Simply click on the red 50-50 ticket in the upper right-hand corner and get your gift certificate for half price. That's 50-50 Friday at KFAR660.com.
Spend your Saturdays with KFAR Radio for local programs, starting with Alaska Realty Today from Next Home Arctic Sun Realty at 11 a.m. The Buzz at 11:30, a look at Alaska's budding new industry, brought to you by Good Titrations, followed by Health Talk with Dr. Scott Looper from White Spruce Medical at noon. Then it's the Compos Outdoor Show at 12:30. And don't miss Bear Banks Foodies at 5:30, talking everything food and fun in Fairbanks. Weekends just got local with KFAR Radio.
Weather brought to you by the professionals at Liberty Tax Service in the Teddy Bear Plaza. Call for a free consultation today, 328-3278. You do life. Let Liberty Tax do your taxes.
KFAR Weather.
Chance for snow today, otherwise overcast skies. Daytime highs approaching 19, northeast winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Lows dip down to about 1 below. Tonight, partly cloudy skies. A mix of clouds and sun again. Tomorrow, daytime highs approaching 25. And that's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Currently, it's 6 degrees below zero.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. In the studio with me, I have Craig Compo, Al Barrett, and Wayne Heimer. And then, in the calling in, I have John Sturgeon. Now, John, you've basically become a de facto solicitor general for Alaska and Alaska rights against federal oversight and takeover.
Not quite sure I got that title, but I feel like I'm always in the middle of it. But I think they're always pretty good causes, and I think that somebody's got to check the federal government, because left unchecked, I think they kind of lose their way sometimes. So somebody's got to keep reminding them.
Very true. Very true.
Oh, so Craig was wanting to know about the harvest out there in Western Arctic Caribou. And so for well over the last 20 years, the harvest's been very consistent. It's been between 13 and 16,000 caribou been harvested annually. And that harvest never really reflects what the population's doing. So as the population was increasing, the harvest was pretty stable. As the population's been decreasing this last 10 years, the harvest is still at 13 to 16,000 caribou being harvested annually. So we get that information through harvest reports and household surveys. And so to me, as a manager or somebody that looks at biology and looks at data, that usually doesn't jive. Usually when populations increase, harvest increases. When populations fall or crash, the harvest crashes with it. But we don't see that in the Western Arctic Caribou herd.
Any thoughts of why that's that way?
The first one comes to mind is, do we have an error in how we collect data on harvest?
Or how we collect data on the herd amount, one way or another.
I mean, we've been pretty consistent on population estimates, so even if we, if that population estimate had some air in it, you would think you would see that in the harvest.
Wayne, you have a thought?
Alternatively, the herd might be so big and the harvest so little that it doesn't make any difference what the level of the herd is, as long as it's so big.
Mm-hmm. The harvest is not a factor in determining the health or the decline of the herd.
It's a possibility.
Is a wolf population more of a influence?
No, it can. There's some data on the Western Arctic caribou herd that that I think it's just moderately high. Some predation on them. That was mainly probably when they were at a higher level than there is right now. But currently, right now, the thing that I look at that's a red flag is the high cow mortality rate that we have. Okay. 3-year-old cows.
Yeah.
And so production still seems to be pretty good, but we're having a die off in older cows.
Do you think there's a thought of a reason for that?
No.
That's climate change.
Yeah.
climate change.
I mean, that's.
I thought it was COVID.
there's been lots of caribou herds, you know, in Canada and Alaska have done the same thing for generations.
Eons, yeah.
And you know, late Patrick Valkenburg, he was always going after that, trying to figure out, you know, what causes a caribou population to crash. It hasn't been solved yet all the time.
Yeah.
We know some of the reasons, but we don't know all of them, basically.
Oh, goodness. John, your thought on the populations, where they're at, it sounds like they've always been sustainable.
Well, I'm not the biologist, but I do know the harvest from non-locals is relatively small. According to Fish and Game, it's average about 212 caribou a year. And you compare that to the size of the herd, you compare that to the harvest by the locals, and it's kind of minuscule.
And you say to yourself, why are we having this conversation? Is this?
No, you have to think that, but the only thing I can think of is I think that maybe all hunters are kind of guilty of the same thing, myself included, is that you have your hunting area and you don't want anybody else in it. And I think that's been going on for thousands of years, and maybe that's something to do with it, too. They just don't want other people in their area. I'm not sure. The biology doesn't support it, and the harvest doesn't support it either. So it just doesn't make a lot of sense. And hopefully it's something that we can get turned around.
The other thing, John, and John was at our Laundry House Gang meeting last Wednesday and did a really thorough discussion on this. And you talked about the shared meat, you know, you talked already about the fact that, you know, most hunters wouldn't really have a problem if there's a biological reason to limit some hunting for a local area. Nobody I think that I know would say, you know, I'm going to go in there regardless of these people can't get their own meat. But talk about the shared meat message, the fact that a lot of the outside hunters and so forth, donate the meat to the locals.
Yeah, there's movement going on called the Natural Harvest Initiative, and they did a lot of work on how people use wild game all the way across the United States. And one incredible thing they found out is that, you know, if you go to the Costco or Safeway and you buy some T-bone steaks or some hamburger, you don't take that T-bone or hamburger and go to your neighbors and say, hey, would you like some of my T-bone steak here? Give them a couple. Doesn't work that way. But wild harvest is a different story. People share that. And there was the factor was, I think, like 1 to 5, in other words, 1 pound of meat, and they pass out to their friends and relatives. Wild game, it's just a different concept. And so I think a lot of people, including myself, prefer to have wild game versus beef. It's just a lot healthier for you. And I think that's another consideration that the federal government should take into account, is that, you know, people like to have healthy wild game, because it's just a lot better for you, period.
It's better for the predators, too, because they have a gut pile to work on. You don't get it at the slaughterhouse and so forth, right? I mean, it's a lot of other benefits.
You've seen too many Tundra commercials. Yeah. It's interesting what you brought up, John. Hunting in rural Alaska is a community event. When, you know, I haven't been moose hunting in a few years, but when I was, growing up at a young age from 10 to 18 years old, anytime our household took a moose, we gave half of it to the Kerstetter family out at Healy Lake. I mean, right then and there. They lived out there. They weren't hunting with us, but we gave half of it to them, to the local population. And that was just them out there at that time. So
I think that's another thing that's really important, that the Alaska professional hunters and their testimony, I think the number is right, but they said the hunters that they bring out there from the rural area, or from the lower 48 and the city areas, that about 80 to 85% of the meat that they get, they leave in the villages.
Yep.
So that's, I think, something that's pretty important, too.
Yep. Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break here. You're listening to a good portion of the Laundry House Gang and John Sturgeon talking about federal subsistence. Going to give you a little bit of bumper music, some Fox News, some state news, some commercials, some weather, and we'll be back in a bit.
Your Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson today pushing back on Republican accusations that she's soft on crime or lenient in child porn cases.
Nothing could be further from the truth.
In the second day of her Senate confirmation hearing, Judge Jackson says judges are bound by statutes in determining a sentence range, and in addition to jail time, handed down additional punishments allowed by law. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has again tested positive for COVID-19. She says President Biden tested negative after socially distanced meetings with her yesterday. Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gilbert says a curfew's in place following recent shootings during spring break.
It's very hard to deter idiots and criminals from doing things.
Police there say a total of 5 people have been shot and at least 9 officers injured this spring break season. America's listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The late Representative Don Young and his legacy will dominate Alaska's first election under the new ranked choice voting system. The Fairbanks Daily Newsminer reports that under state law, Governor Mike Dunleavy must call a special election to finish out Young's term. When a U.S. House or Senate seat is vacated, a special primary election must be scheduled by the governor within 90 days. The special primary election will be followed by a special general election. State law requires the special general election to be held at least 60 days after the special primary election. Dates have yet to be determined. A special election will be scheduled to determine Young's replacement. The winner will finish out the term, which ends in January 2023. The last time Alaska held a special election was in 1973 to fill the same office, Alaska's only House seat. Young was first elected 49 years ago to finish Representative Nick Begich's term after the Alaska-bound plane Begich traveled in disappeared and was never found. Young won that special election and went on to serve for 25 consecutive terms. He had said that a 26th term would be his last in public office.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
When it's time to update your home, you can count on Spinar Builder Supply to have what you need to get your project done right the first time. From initial design to custom manufacturing to walking through the handcrafted door of your dreams, SBS is your home improvement partner. Whether you're ready to start your next project or you're just starting the plan, we are here to help. Just ask SBS. With quality brands like Therma-True, find the perfect new door to fit your home style right here at Spinar Builder Supply.
Hello, Fairbanks. Dave Bridges here from Altrol Heating, Cooling, and Plumbing. Hey, natural gas is here. We're at the top of the gas utilities and the borough's approved contractor list for oil and gas conversions. We have licensed and experienced techs and installers and would love to give you a free quote. Call Altrol Heating, Cooling, and Plumbing today. Since 1982, the company you can trust, 452-8680, or online at altrolinc.com.
Ice fishing is great winter fun if you're prepared. Before you make your fishing hole in the ice, make Frontier Outfitters your first stop for everything you need. Rods to tackle to ice augers. At Frontier Outfitters, you'll also find the right winter clothing. Not to mention your license, guns, ammo, and a wide variety of snowshoes. ATV and snow machine accessories are just downstairs in Century Hardware. Your next outdoor adventure is waiting for you. It begins at Frontier Outfitters for your Alaskan lifestyle.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I've got John Sturgeon calling in, Wayne Heimer, Al Barrett, and Craig Compo in the studio with me. Now, the time frame for comment is over. So the March 31st, that's where it's discussed and voted up or down one way or another.
Yeah, I think that's correct, and it's what they said last night when we were in between testimonies. They would, you know, give out information like that, and if I'm wrong, you know, John can correct me on that.
John, right, wrong, or indifferent?
That's the way I understand it. It's actually it's the 30th, I believe, not the 31st, but that's when they're going to make an up or down decision. But the management has proposed some alternative, so we'll see what they come up with.
What? When you said we'll see what they come up with, you know, over 40 million acres, and sadly, federal subsistence management is never in favor of state rights. So you've been a frontline defender of state rights. What would you propose to happen if this did not go in a way that protects the state of Alaska's hunting and fishing rights on an equal basis for its citizens?
Well, that is a very long
it's a very,
long answer.
Yeah, it's a very calculated question, too.
Yeah. Well, I think there's I think the first step, I guess, would be to try to let the Federal Subsistence Board know the error of their ways, that they're not following the intent or of Title 8 of ANILCA. I think that'd be the first thing, come administrative requests, and there's something called request for rulemaking, asking them to change it. Those are all administrative procedures, and there's quite a few of them in the federal government. And also there's things that they're maybe not following. Federal government also has a lot of procedural things that we don't think they're following properly, like the Open Meetings Act, that kind of thing. So I think that'd be the first step. And then I think a very, very last step would be some kind of legal action. But, you know, from my Supreme Court case, that's kind of a crapshoot. You never quite know how it's going to work out. Plus, it can be very expensive and very long. My case was $1.6 million, and it was 13 years from beginning to end. So it's that's kind of a tough tough question.
Yeah, Woodsick weighing on him for that one.
Well, I think the answer that that I prefer, and maybe the one that you are trolling for, is that the Federal Subsistence Board just needs to go away.
Exactly.
It serves no purpose. It's duplicative. It's expensive. And it really presents the impression to the locals that they are the managers. Now, the Federal Subsistence Board doesn't have to do whatever the RACs, Regional Advisory Councils, say. But if they don't, they have to explain why. And they have traditionally been very reluctant to say, because that doesn't fit in ANILCA.
Have they ever said that?
I'm unaware that they have.
I have a question. You know, when you talk, you know, we have to get away from this mentality that the federal government can save all, do all. Let's look at the fish crisis last year. You know, when Virgil's out, Virgil and some other outfits, they shipped how many pounds of fish out to the villages?
Oh, a lot.
How much federal, how much of that was federal? So, you know, I mean, isn't there, can't we handle this stuff, these biological emergencies, by ourselves? We can do that as a state and under the Constitution.
First of all, no one does it better than the state of Alaska. You know, you take your biologists, the recommendations, your board of games, your fish and game management, and if you take the politics out of it, you probably have the best run area game management in the world. But you put in the federal government, politics, boom, it all goes downhill very fast. You guys ready for a phone call?
Sure.
Here we go. Good morning. You're on KFAR Radio, and your name is?
Mike.
Hello, Mike.
Hello there. Hey, I was just had a curiosity. I was just curious why the state is so opposed to people doing things like stocking ponds and helping with salmon streams and kind of doing it the way that the original Alaska natives used to do it when they were stocking streams with salmon fry and salmon eggs, and then in particular, you know, local lakes and things like that. I just was curious if you guys had any insight into that.
Good question, Mike. I'm going to give that one to Wayne.
There have been, I think it's a fear that we're going to screw things up. You know, in the early days of transplanting this and that kind of willy-nilly everywhere, mistakes got made. And, you know, rabbits in Australia, you know, or other things like that. And with the invention or the maturity of
mongoose in Hawaii now.
Yeah, with the maturity of wildlife management and beginning to understand things a little better, the department is very jumpy about people doing stuff on their own.
What's that, John?
I'm particularly talking about indigenous populations that currently exist here, not introducing foreign species, but helping to promulgate the comeback for the salmon, like the Chena River, for example, or the Delta Clearwater, or some of these other tributaries down in the Anchorage Bowl.
I would look at it as power and control.
Well, thinking that's probably the case. I'm just wondering why we're putting up with it.
I think it started as a fear that people that weren't as smart as us, you know, might make mistakes.
Well, it's very disappointing. I've got a lake that I'd like to put some fish into that I could catch out of the Tina or some other place and introduce them into that lake. It's a local lake. It'd be great to have people fishing there. The state of Alaska kind of has some rules that I don't really want to adhere to with respect to opening up my private property to other folks. But, you know, and then, of course, you know, watching what's going on with the salmon. I've been here 41 years and relied on Chitna for 35 of those years for my subsistence fishing. And, you know, now you go down there and you can't catch kings and you can't do this and you can't do that. And I'm watching all this stuff kind of disappear, and it's kind of scary.
Very true. Very true.
Alrighty. Well, I just
Mike, appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
Now, John, I know you have to leave at the next break we have, but there's a final question I'm going to give you. And that's basically, what can concerned people do next about this potential oversight from the feds?
Well, I think there's a lot of things they can do. One, they can let the Federal Subsistence Board know their thoughts. I think they can let our congressional delegation know what their thoughts are. And I think they can get involved. There's a lot of clubs Wild Sheep Foundation, Safari Club, Alaska Outdoor Council, a lot of other organizations that are working on this problem. And if you want to see it go away, you've got to put in the time, you got to put in the money. And I think that's probably the best way to influence into it. And again, let our congressional delegation know what's going on, and even our local state officials. I think the governor has a budget request for $10 million, what he calls the Statehood Defense Fund, and it would be used for things like this, for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to be able to manage all the wildlife across the state. And I think that's the kind of thing that the governor has been pushing for a long, long time. And his $10 million that he's requested, that's what it's going to go for. So supporting those kind of things, I think, would be very, very useful.
Well, John, we're going to let you go. We really appreciate your being able to call in and lend very good education knowledge to this conversation and bringing it up and highlighting it, making everyone aware of it. I really appreciate the phone call, and you take care.
And Fairbanks, thank you for having me, and I always enjoy talking to folks in Fairbanks. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And Fairbanks, we are going to take a commercial break. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
When you think of the Turtle Club, you think of the salad bar, the prawns, and of course their world-famous prime rib. The next time you take the short drive out to the Turtle Club, keep in mind they also have rich lobster tails with melted butter, Alaska King crab legs, and so much more. Every ounce is delicious. And stop in soon and check out their new renovations. The Turtle Club has set the standard for delicious surf and turf in Fairbanks for over 70 years. The promise of a combination of fresh ingredients, expert preparation, and friendly service will create a fine dining experience that you can only find at the Turtle Club.
The Fairbanks Hearing and Ballot Center has big news. It's that time when all the major hearing aid manufacturers release new products. Dr. Marianne McElwain and her team are excited to already dispense the latest products from Starkey, Phonak, and ReSound, but they're even prouder to offer best practices to fit your hearing aids using systems like Real Ear to better fit your hearing aids to your specific hearing loss. They even offer lower-cost hearing devices fitted by a licensed audiologist with a warranty and service plan. It's time to hear better and feel better. It's all at the Fairbanks Hearing and Ballot Center. Find out more at fairbankshearing.com.
Weather brought to you by Bigfoot Pumping and Thawing, offering 24-hour service from Salcha to Nanana and no mileage charge on callouts. The Bigfoot with the helping hand. Bigfoot Pumping and Thawing.
KFAR weather.
Chance for snow today, otherwise overcast skies. Daytime highs approaching 19, northeast winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Lows dip down to about 1 below. Tonight, partly cloudy skies. A mix of clouds and sun again. Tomorrow, daytime highs approaching 25. And that's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Currently, it's 6 degrees below zero.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. And I hope you appreciate the education, knowledge, background, and experience that the four people presenting today have given, John Sturgeon, Wayne Heimer, Al Barrett, and Craig Compo, a very knowledgeable, wonderful working group for the state of Alaska. And we have a phone call we're going to take. Okay, gentlemen?
Yep.
Good morning. You're on KFUR Radio, and your name is?
Hi, my name is Mike.
Hello, Mike.
So, Mr. Compo made some points about the state managing stuff, and while his points are correct, what everybody needs to realize is that the state has been forbidden to do something by our Supreme Court that the federal government still can do, and that is discriminate by location or where you live. So that created a special interest group, in other words, rural residents. As long as those rural residents get special treatment, they're going to fight for that. So in my estimation, the angle on this, if it's still possible, to go back to the courts and work on discrimination. I mean, our Supreme Court said that you can't do that in the state, so wouldn't there be something in the federal constitution that prohibits discrimination based on where you live? So that's the point I want to make, and your experts there can talk about that.
Thank you. Mike, discrimination based on race, creed, color, national origin, familial status, sexual orientation, or disabilities is outlawed by the United States. Simple as that.
Unless you're getting nominated for Supreme Court.
I stand corrected as usual, Mr. Barrett. But, yes, Mr. Heimer.
But as you look through ANILCA, you see that the rationale that was given for providing discrimination had to do with the trust responsibility for Native Americans, which existed from colonial times. So the Congress claims that it is doing this in fulfillment of its trust responsibility for, which is a little different than trust responsibility to, which is what it has become, for Native Americans. And they also simply sort of hug in the Commerce Clause as well. Now, I don't want to go too far out in the weeds because I'll get lost, for one thing. But the Commerce Clause really doesn't have a heck of a lot to do with this. That has to do with commerce between states, making sure that there will be free commerce between the states. What that's got to do with subsistence in Alaska is a little
for me. If we were a province of Russia, would we have this issue?
No, we'd be glad for oil.
Yeah, exactly.
I got a question for Al.
We would also probably be raping and pillaging all of our national resources, too. Yeah. So,
you know, one of the arguments that John said that the group made that started the RAC was that the out-of-region hunters come in and, and they shoot the first caribou they see, and it turns the migration and all that. To me, it's such a weak argument. Is that a sign that the desperation of the argument, or is that a sign that they're assuming people are going to buy that argument? I mean, is there any factual? There's no factual.
It's got to be a sign that they'll buy the argument, because most people that are not local or a hunter don't know that the last caribou I shot was the last one of a herd of 70 that came through my camp, because it was the big bull pushing his harem. Yes, Wayne.
The first we heard about this, in my experience anyway, which goes back to the very early 70s, came out of Anaktuvuk Pass. And, the caribou herd that idea first came to, white people's ears from Anaktuvuk Pass, because, Anaktuvuk is a caribou migration corridor. And it was the tradition and lore at Anaktuvuk Pass that if you shot the first ones through, they wouldn't deter the whole herd. Well, that kind of turned into a little bit of a growth industry in Native politics and resource allocation. And the next time I knew about it was down on the Alaska Peninsula, where the same claim was made by people that were on the Pacific side, which is the bad weather side where caribou don't go.
Yeah.
They were saying, well, the people up in the passes are shooting the caribou and they're not coming down here where they didn't want to be anyway, biologically. And they're all staying over on the lee side of the Aleutians.
Instead of the windward side.
Yeah, and it has popped up everywhere. It's along the Ambler Road. It's out in, you know, whether it's always been lore or traditional ecological knowledge, I don't know. But we first became aware of it at Anaktuvuk Pass.
You know, it was interesting. I saw a photo of a wolf pack, and there was like in a single file, and there's like 16. And it showed the hierarchy of the line, you know, the ones that were in the first five was a specific subset, then the younger ones, then the breeding female. At the very end, the only one with the tail up was the leader of the pack, and he was the last one, making sure no one was left behind, no one's coming up from behind, not having to break trail. And so your argument that the lead bull is in the lead, sorry, it's not that way in nature. It's just not.
Yeah, I was just confused of why they feel that was such a strong argument to kind of put it out front. It just doesn't carry any weight that I can see. Is there any reason you think, Al, that they would lean on that argument? I don't know.
Oh, well, it's not their argument. It's their belief. Mm-hmm. You know, something they've been raised and taught for generations. And so if we look back a generation ago, the caribou herd was starting to grow, and there was lots of opportunity until, you know, it got to the top, almost 500,000 caribou. So when caribou get to that, those great numbers, they expand their ranges. And they were visiting villages for 10 years or better, almost 20 years, where there was, you know, abundance. Everybody could have caribou, and they just had to wait for them and let some go.
The way you caribou hunt is just sitting in a location and waiting for them to walk by.
And today, we're down under 200,000 caribou, that migration pattern's much smaller. You don't need the range that you need to support 500,000 caribou. Yeah. And so people aren't seeing them, and they got to blame some reason why don't we have caribou like we did 10 years ago coming through here.
So basically, what I heard John say, maybe what Wayne said it, or maybe Al, you said it, out of 13,000 harvested in this area, 212 were from non-local hunters.
They were from non-residents.
Non-residents.
Just under 1,000 caribou from non-locals and non-residents combined. So
what percent? Was it 3%? What percent is of the harvest is circle? I thought I heard 3% at one point of the
Well, surplus. They average about just under 14,000 caribou a year harvested totally. And 1,000, just round numbers, about 1,000 of them were taken by non-resident non-locals.
How much fun can you have?
I can't do percents like that in my head.
well, me neither, but that without my HP calculator, you know, what the heck.
I did a study one time, though. I took an average of 14,000 caribou harvested up there, and it edible meat, that's about 80-90 pounds, so I went with 90 pounds on the higher side, and got the U.S. Census for the entire region that the Western Arctic caribou herd patterned every village that was in that range, and divided that by the usable pounds of meat, and it came out to a quarter pounder a day.
Is that with cheese?
Yeah. So everybody could eat a quarter pound of caribou meat a day, would equal 14,000 caribou in the area.
Boy. So we have 5 minutes left, and since we have remnants of the Laundry House Gang here, Al, what should we be doing this month for hunting and fishing and getting out?
I don't know. I'll be doing my taxes. I'm focused.
You got till April 15th. We're in the last 10 days of March.
Oh, there's always extensions, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So what would your recommendation be?
I think it's that time when the sun's out longer and it's getting nicer weather that, you know, ice fishing is what has always get on my mind.
Yep. Craig, how about you?
Same thing. Maybe burbot fishing on the good pasture. Yeah. Ice fishing. I love poor mountain's lobster.
Wayne?
I think maybe snow machining. The snow is very forgiving in the local area now.
But Craig's out of snow machines, and he's sold out of 2023, and they're not even here yet. Yeah.
I've got a broken down one.
Ready for a phone call, gentlemen?
Yeah, let's do it.
Good morning. You're on KFAR Radio with the Laundry House Gang, and your name is?
This is Matt Heller.
Hello, Matt. How you doing?
Oh, not too bad. I did a lot of studying on the same stuff that you guys are talking about that snowshoe beaver trail. a lot of all that stuff came up because that trail's like 1,200 miles. It's four different sections, and it goes right up through a lot of those units. And I end up reading a lot of that same stuff that you guys are talking about. Some of the places had real low game take. I mean, real bad low for some of those villages. Has anything happened on that trail out there? Have you heard anything about Live and Good and all that?
No, that not heard anything in the wings about that trail or any other trails going on around that area. White Mountains.
So I know that they that Hillcorp did drill 15 test wells down there last summer.
Yeah.
And fall. And so that is moving forward. And it's going to become a problem with access there and everything. It's hooked in, and they hooked right into all that subsistence stuff and everything. I mean, once you got into it, I mean, they're planting a lot of stuff there. And it's a lot, huge area they're talking about closing down.
Okay. Thank you for the phone call. Greatly appreciate it. You take care.
Yep.
I have two thoughts of what you should do for the final 9-8 days of March. First thought is go out to Wayne Heimer's house and harvest squirrels.
Yes.
They're coming out now. They're coming out, and he has a plethora of squirrels. And the second thing is I would take advantage of Kramer's Field now, walking, hiking, cross-country skiing, because when it starts melting, that is going to be one big soggy area, and you're not going to be able to, you know, step foot out there for about 2 weeks, I would think, just with all the water.
Maybe at least 2 weeks if we get a hot melt.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And we're all hoping for a slow melt.
I kind of seen the same situation downtown.
Yeah. and with Craig taking over the outdoor show on Saturdays for Mike Hajdukovic, mm-hmm. or from Mike Hajdukovic, and since Wayne said go ride a snow machine, my thought is go to tracks, get some skis, and go cross-country skiing up at Birch Hill. Is that about right, Craig? How long have you known them, Hajdukovic?
And then, on your way up there, if you see some guys snow machining about, you might consider a machine for 2024.
You know, I'm going to tell a high school story with Craig Compo and a Hajdukovic.
Yeah.
And we're like juniors, and Craig comes into, you know, our homeroom or whatever it was, and he's just happy as all get out. Because him and Johnny were out snow machining on Fort Wainwright.
Oh yeah.
And they were on Elance, and these MPs just got stuck trying to chase these two
Panthers, Arctic Cat Panthers.
Yeah, these two wanted teenagers, you know, invading federal property. And he was happy. We're gonna take a phone call real fast, and then we're gonna close her up.
All right.
You got a minute? And your name is?
Mark, how are you doing today?
Hurry up, Mark.
Yes, I'd just like to remind you and the listeners there, your wonderful guests, the underfooting, the 90% ownership interest of Alaskans to federal lands is being thieved. Now, they're going to clear the surface and zero in on just specialized users, and then the rest is going to the oligarchs to trade for this fictitious debt, so you just better get ready for it.
Okay, Mark, thank you for the phone call. We got to go. And gentlemen, thank you very much. I had to throw in that little final comment about Craig Compo and his, you know, obnoxious ways of eluding...
Johnny made me do it.
Of eluding MPs on snow machines. And it's so funny. He was laughing. He goes, yeah, we had an Elan and they couldn't touch us.
No.
Fairbanks, I will see you tomorrow.